You were in the wrong place at the wrong time. You can say goodbye to your car. The investigators were surprised and said, no, you're just witnesses. You're not prisoners of war. So who are we? You're detainees. You weren't supposed to do anything. You weren't allowed to sit for the first month and a half up until August 2023. We stood for 16 hours at a time, got up at 6 a.m., and went to bed at 10 p.m. What is this tough special forces unit from Kyiv doing there? If you watch their TV, it seems like Russia is surrounded by enemies they have to destroy. That's why there's only one way to protect ourselves from this. The only way is to prepare a response. Well, now there's no need to prepare it anymore. We have to fight to the end.
Russia's aggression against Ukraine has served as a kind of icebreaker, shattering dozens, if not hundreds, of red lines of international law, civilized society, and basic humanity. One example that illustrates this is the existence of so-called civilian prisoners held in Russian prisons. To this day, I have had the opportunity to speak with many prisoners of war. These are people who took up arms, joined the military, and ultimately ended up in Russian captivity. And there may be some logic to that because they became soldiers. But today I have a guest, Serhiy Akhmetov, a man who did not take up arms, who simply lived in a certain city, in a certain area where the Russians came, and thus he was taken captive by them. Serhiy, hello. You spent 3.5 years in captivity, yet you are a civilian person, correct? Do you have a, do you have an answer to the question of exactly why you spent 3.5 years in a Russian prison?
Honestly, no, it's not clear at all. At the very beginning, when the arrest itself took place, when they were taking me to the basement at Gostomel Airport, and while we were there, we were most likely some kind of bargaining chip for potential exchanges, a human shield, because, for example, they were transporting us, they were transporting me on an IFV on top of the vehicle, and then they said that this was so that your Ukrainian soldiers, whoever is watching and adjusting the fire, would see that two civilians are being transported in the IFV. It was in the prisons, during the very first interrogation. The initial interrogations were just questioning. They weren't very difficult for me. I asked, and the investigators replied that we were witnesses. That is it. No charges, no accusations that I had done anything wrong there, violated some criminal code of the Russian Federation or anything else. Nothing like that happened. We were just supposedly witnesses in some criminal case. I don't know exactly which one. But we signed all the protocols as witnesses. Although it's just a small step from being a witness to being an accused person, if you know what I mean.
Well, look, let's get to that legal aspect a bit later. I wanted you to start from the very beginning because not only are you a civilian who was held captive, but you also lived and currently live in Bucha?
Yes, I do.
Yes, in that very same Bucha, which is already widely known because of what happened there. But you were taken prisoner before any mass killings took place there.
You see, I was taken prisoner when they were already happening, but no one knew about it yet. But when they threw me into the basement of that Gostomel airport, there were people with us, civilians too, I emphasize, specifically civilians, who told us what was happening there and very, very bad things were happening there. I've already mentioned that when they forced us to do something, to clean up at that airport, it turned out that out of 10 or 11 of us, only 3 were able to walk. The rest were badly beaten, with fractures, just battered. I mean, all that had already happened, and many didn't even make it to our basement.
If you're interested in the story, leave a comment and like the video right below this one. This will support our project. Have you ever thought from this perspective that maybe a Russian prison saved you from what might have been waiting for you on the street?
Let me put it this way. If I hadn't been arrested near my house and I had gone to the evacuation convoy's assembly point for Kyiv, I wouldn't have made it there because all the civilian cars were shot up and wrecked and only Russian military vehicles were moving along the roads. And if I had left and I would have had to drive about 3 kilometers through Gostomel, then I would have realized that there was no assembly point there. I would have gone to Bucha, which is another 10 kilometers. There was zero chance I would have made it anywhere. I realized that what saved me was that I was taken prisoner.
But in this case, it was probably also saved in quotes, because if there hadn't been invasion, people would have lived their lives and gone about their usual business. By the way, what were you doing up until 2022?
A lot of things. I started out as a mathematician, a cyberneticist, a programmer, then moved into business, holding management positions. Then, starting in 2015, I left and started doing my own stuff. Equipment for children's play areas, all kinds of shopping centers. I tried to develop my own production. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough money for the equipment. So I just went to work and at the same time to learn. But it all ended.
February 23rd. Do you remember the day before the invasion? What were you thinking about then? Were you planning your life ahead or did you realize the Russians were coming?
On February 23rd, I was working on my own project at the factory. I was there as an apprentice CNC machine operator. And on February 23rd, I worked on it by myself, without anyone else. I planned to tweak it a bit on the 24th. I didn't like the way I'd done it. It turned out okay, but I knew I'd come to work tomorrow and quickly fix it up.
What were your thoughts on the Russian invasion?
I didn't believe it. I didn't believe it at all because it would be suicide for Russia. Anyone with even a passing interest in history knows this. I understood that this would be the complete end for the Russian Federation, and I didn't believe it. Although, for some reason, when I was returning at night from the 23rd to the 24th, instead of going straight home, for reasons I don't know, I stopped at a convenience store, bought myself a bunch of food, and filled up half a tank of gas in the car. Although I hadn't planned on it at all, but I don't know why I did it. A lot of things happened there afterward that I didn't even do on a whim. I don't know why I did them, but it turned out to be useful.
Some instincts must have kicked in.
I don't know. It wasn't instincts. An instinct is something where you at least realize it might come in handy. But right then, on TV and online, our leaders were saying there wouldn't be any war, that everything would be fine, everything would be okay. But for some reason, I was doing things that could be seen as preparing for a possible disaster. And as for why I did that, I don't know, honestly. And then there will be events that will once again leave us at a dead end. That's not instinct.
I'm also curious about your attitude toward Russia before 2014, before 2022, whether it changed or not. Was that country okay with you or not okay?
Russia? Well, you see, my father was from Kazan, a Tatar. My mother, though she was born in the Chernihiv region, lived for a while in the Bryansk region, not far from the famous Novozibkov. I have a neutral attitude toward Russia because I have relatives there, and although we don't keep in touch, they're still there. I used to be neutral, thinking maybe that something was wrong with their heads, but when we were already there in those prisons, I saw the whole truth. I saw what they were watching on TV and how their minds were being completely brainwashed, and I realized this was going to be a long haul.
Did you learn about the events in Bucha while in captivity?
On April 8th, 2022, when they gave us a TV, we saw not even the news, but all kinds of talk shows and analytical programs on the ORT channel. And we realized that, first of all, something even more terrible had happened in Bucha than what I'd heard in the cell. Well, and second, we saw exactly what is being fed into the minds of Russian citizens. And it's terrifying. At first, we didn't believe it when we were talking to Russian soldiers in the basement of the Gostomel airport. We thought maybe they were joking, maybe they hadn't been brainwashed that thoroughly yet. But when we saw the intensity of the propaganda on ORT and other channels, we realized that this is probably incurable. It can be cured. But as they say, it's a long and difficult process. The understanding of what war is comes when bombs are exploding in your streets. To paraphrase what happened in Nazi Germany in 1945, the epiphany comes when the war comes to you. It comes back. Yes, and so far, that hasn't happened on a massive scale for them yet, although it has definitely started.
As for how brainwashed they are, I have a comrade, my friend Vlad Zadorin, who was one of the defenders of Zmini Island. That famous phrase about the Russian warship go fuck yourself came out from there. And so he told me that when they were taken prisoner there, the special forces who came in said they were going through and thoroughly checking this whole little island, which is basically just solid rock. They combed through it looking for a button that would open some kind of hatch to a biological laboratory where some combat dolphins or mosquitoes or whatever they were planning to find. And they were really looking for it.
I'll tell you more. When we first moved to the first prison in the Bryansk region, in Novozibkov, they constantly asked us during interrogations about laboratories, about organ transplants, about organ removal, about the organ trade.
What was your reaction to that?
Sometimes I'd quote lines from Soviet movies. There was one film where Papanov, I think, said the line, "If a man is an idiot, it's for the long haul." Honestly, we were surprised that people believed that.
People ask you, where are the biolabs in your neighborhood? Did you laugh?
It was dangerous to laugh. I just explained that, first of all, we don't know, and second, we've never even heard of such a thing. Just laughing like that. No, that's a bad idea. You could get beaten up for that.
Okay, let's go back then to what we actually started with. But what were you accused of? Why were you arrested there and then detained?
Very briefly, I was seized by a group of soldiers who were looking for a mortar that was firing somewhere nearby. I don't know where it was firing from, but the explosions were very close. And here I was, driving out in my car. I was clean, the car was clean, a white flag. Then I saw what the local civilians looked like, and I didn't look anything like them. I was clean and I didn't reek of smoke. Well, that was suspicious, so they decided I needed to be sent to headquarters for questioning. They questioned me quickly there. Fortunately, they didn't beat me. They even gave me their own shoes because I was barefoot. They took my boots, so they gave me their Russian military ones, and they promised they'd let me go in a couple of weeks, once things settled down and it got quieter, and send me home. Later, we were practically prisoners, and the guy in charge who was holding us, a captain, though maybe not a captain, came up to us. He was the one who later said something like, "You were in the wrong place at the wrong time. You can say goodbye to your car."
Well, but okay, in the wrong place at the wrong time, that's not a reason to detain someone.
You see, for us, that's not a reason, but for them, it's normal. They just held us for some reason. And instead of letting us go, they quickly took us to Belarus in 5 days, to a filtration camp where our soldiers were already being held captive. And there we became prisoners of war, all of us.
So they told you that you were prisoners of war?
Worse. On the evening of March 16th, 2022, around 9 or 10 o'clock, they forced us to sign documents. They issued prisoner of war cards to all of us who were there. If you were a civilian, you just didn't have to fill in any information there, just a line or two, but everyone was given prisoner of war status. And when they interrogated us a week later in Novozibkov, the investigators were surprised and said, "No, you're just witnesses, you're not prisoners of war. So who are we? You're detainees."
For what?
We didn't know, just detainees. Then, in Mordovia, when I answered the question, "Who are you?" with "We're just detainees," I got hit on the head. They didn't say who exactly, they just hit me on the head.
Our podcast is aimed at an international audience, so I'll try to explain it this way again. A man was living in his own home. The Russians came, took him essentially, I don't know, as a hostage or something. Figuratively speaking, they detained him, placed him in their detention facilities without charging him with any, well, not just any, but absolutely no violation of the law or other rules and regulations. So what do you call that? Because it seems to me that this is called terrorism.
Terrorism, kidnapping. I don't know. They never once told us what we were guilty of. I saw people being taken away for interrogation as prisoners of war, and some were even taken to court. I know a couple of people like that, but they haven't asked us a single question. So we're just here in Mordovia, just standing around. For what? We don't know. Just for being Ukrainian.
I'm actually kind of curious how they document this. I mean, they have their own bureaucracy that's supposed to record everything. One plus one has to add up there.
Here, a guy just walked in off the street. Let me put it this way. Sometime in early December 2023, a representative of the Russian Federation's ombudsman, Ms. Moskalkova, a man named, I think, Chichilinsky. And when he first came in, and we were the first cell, as I understand it, he was going through them in order, entering each cell, and we were probably the first. He came into our cell and was a little surprised when he was told that out of 10 people here, I think 7 are civilians, and only 3 are military.
Hello, world. Wake up!
That's the thing. And they say there are, well, 10 to 15,000 civilians in Russia.
Who are being held without any grounds? Okay, well, if you just think about it, try to find some logic in this. Do you have a theory as to why they did this? For what purpose?
I think that they realized, right at the first stage of the invasion, they realized that many Russian soldiers had been captured, while Ukrainian soldiers were hardly being captured in sufficient numbers for an exchange. So they started kidnapping Ukrainian civilians. And understand, they kidnapped everyone. 18 years old, we take them. 70 years old, we take them. Mentally ill, we take them. Barely able to walk, we take them.
Those 7 who were in the same cell with you, what kind of people were they? Who were they?
All very different. Just ordinary civilians.
Who were just living their lives and ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time? Were there any among them who, for example, sympathized with Russia?
I personally didn't have anyone like that in my cell. There was one person who wrote 2 applications to Putin for citizenship while he was there. When asked, "Why are you doing this?" he replied, "I'm tired of all this. I'm fed up. I want to get out."
Did it help him?
No, he's still in prison.
Is he still there?
I think so. As of October 2nd, 2025, he was still in a cell.
You served the bulk of your sentences in Mordovia, but you were also in Pakino, right? And in the Bryansk pre-trial detention center?
Very briefly. A short stint in Pakino, yes. A year in the Bryansk pre-trial detention center and in the region. A year and a little over 2 years in Mordovia.
You were in Pakino for a month. Are you familiar with names like Pilipe, Malik, Kulko, Zadorin?
No, I only found out about them here.
Okay, I'll give you a little peek behind the scenes of what's been going on here. Obviously, we don't record this podcast just once a month or every 2 weeks. We record several episodes in a single day, several. And we've already had a meeting with the previous guest who was just on the podcast. That was Ruslan Odeyski. And it turned out that he and Serhii were in the same building, heard the same nightingale, about whom, by the way, I'd like to ask you to tell us who that is. And they didn't know about each other's existence or that they were in the same place at the same time.
I have to explain why I didn't know this man, because they never took us out so we could see everyone who was there. Well, anyone in the neighboring cells. Sometimes they would take two cells out at the same time for the x-ray. But we stood by the wall. We couldn't see, we could only hear. If one cell is in the corridor for a roll call, the other prisoners are sitting in their cells, and we could only hear a surname, for example, and even that was very, very rare. Two cells to the left, two cells to the right, and the 10th cell was further away. Unfortunately, I didn't hear the man from Brovary, but I'm very glad he's back.
Who is Solovey or Nightingale?
He's a prisoner of war, I think from the 36th Brigade. He's over 50, maybe around 60. I know because I was in a cell with an officer, with officers from that 36th Brigade. They said he also served in Afghanistan when the Soviet Union invaded there. He has a very good singing voice, he sings well, and that really, really helps. It helps in general. First of all, it's the ability to sing. Yes, it's hard, because sometimes they can force you to sing even for a whole hour. But it saves your cell, and maybe everyone in that entire block, because somehow everything goes smoothly.
And did he sing the Russian anthem, which you have to sing every day, or something else?
He didn't sing those songs at all. He sang Soviet pop and modern pop. I mean, the guy knows his stuff. He can sing. And that really helped.
And I understand that everyone in this colony knows about Solovey.
Yes, I heard him back in Pakino, and then they transferred all of us at once to Mordovia.
During the transfers to Mordovia and Pakino, were the intake procedures rough?
In Novozibkov, it was very brutal. They broke two ribs on my left side during intake there. After that, I couldn't sleep on my left side for a month. In Pakino, there was no beating at all, neither during intake nor during our stay. But we were there for about 2 months, a little less than a month and a half. Mordovia is terrible. They beat us.
I constantly mention the intake process in every conversation because I'm trying to catch the attention of the very people who are watching us and find someone who might try to influence the situation so that this barbarism is eradicated. Because there is some logic, some purpose when a soldier is captured in a combat zone and is interrogated, possibly with torture, because there is an interest in obtaining some information. But prijomka is a completely unnecessary form of sadism that solves nothing. Why, yes, a person who ends up in a penal colony will follow the rules that are in place there anyway. Whether they beat you at the start or not, nothing will change. What's the point? Mutilating people like that for no reason at all? This needs to change. If you know someone who can influence this, then do so. In general, if we're talking not just about intake, but about daily life in the colony, how much cruelty did you encounter along the way?
Somewhere around, if we're talking about Novozibkov, from March 20th, 2022 to May 11th, 2023, it was rough at the beginning, then more or less calm.
And by rough, what do you mean? Beatings? What kind? Can you describe them?
We'd go out into the hallway for a check, just standing there. They'd walk by and hit anyone with a hand, a foot, a baton, or a stun gun. Just like that.
Did they care about someone who was older, maybe weaker?
Sometimes, oddly enough. But sometimes the Caucasians behaved more restrainedly than, say, the Buryats or Slavs in general. The Caucasians tried not to touch the older ones.
Were there any women there? Were the women kept separate?
We were in Novozibkov until around April 4th. On March 31st, they moved us from the new building to the old one. And on our floor, not far from us, there was a cell, and there were, I think, four women there. But after, I think, April 4th, they were transferred somewhere, either taken away or moved, probably taken away. They said, perhaps for an exchange. I didn't hear of any more women.
While they were there, those women, how were they treated?
More calmly. They were intimidated, yeah, something like that. There were hints that some kind of sexual violence might happen, but we didn't hear any screams.
So basically psychological pressure?
Yes. Well, and plus, they, well, communicated with them very politely, listened to what they wanted, what their problems were. I don't know if that helped. I know we tried, well, personally, I tried shouting my last name so they might remember it. And if they were taken to an exchange, maybe they'd say they'd heard of this oligarch.
An oligarch?
Well, Renat Leonidovich Akhmetov, he's not a relative of mine, but the surname is well known. I didn't even know that. You see, until January 4th, 2025, I didn't know what had happened to my children. I didn't know at all whether they even knew I was alive. That's why I tried to get in touch with them somehow. by any means possible.
Essentially, your relatives didn't know where you were or what had happened to you?
I thought they didn't know, but as it turned out, when I returned, they already knew. They'd known since around April 2022. They found me on this Telegram channel called Nemizida. It's Russian. And they saw me, looking pretty rough, having voluntarily surrendered. Yeah, it's funny. And they knew I was on the territory of the Russian Federation. They tried to get in touch. They tried. Well, of course, they received two or three letters from me there. We didn't write anymore. Well, I received the first letter only a year ago, in January 2025.
So for 2.5 years, you knew nothing?
Nothing.
What was your situation with food?
At Gostomel Airport, in the basement, it was bad. You see, there was a time when we got 3 spoonfuls of porridge, 3 small cookies, and a small glass of water a day. At Novosibki, yes, it was better than Gostomel Airport, but I lost about 25 kilograms. I mean, I couldn't run anymore. I could walk, but if I ran, I'd fall. In Pakino, it was more or less okay. But in Mordovia, surprisingly, I regained my 70 kilograms. So the food situation in Mordovia was more or less good. However, the strictest regime was in Mordovia.
How would you describe it? What exactly were you supposed to do or not do there?
That's exactly the point. You weren't supposed to do anything. You weren't allowed to sit for the first month and a half up until August 2023. We stood for 16 hours at a time, got up at 6 a.m. and went to bed at 10 p.m. every inspection. Fortunately, there was only one here because in Novozibkov and Pakino there were 2, morning and evening, but in Mordovia only the morning one. But it was intense. They beat us with sticks, batons.
So an inspection is basically they open the cell and check if everything is in order?
You're dragged out into the hallway, facing the wall, bent over, hands up behind your back so it's easier to beat you. And while someone's watching inside the cell, we get slapped, punched, and shocked with stun guns. They could set a dog on you. For example, I was bitten by a dog on July 18th, 2023.
And was this a daily ritual?
Well, not the dog, but the beatings, yes.
Beatings every day?
Well, practically. And this went on all the way until January 11th to 18th, 2025. But starting in January 2025, somehow it all stopped. So yes, they intimidated us, mocked us, and humiliated us. But they practically didn't beat us. They might have slapped us.
What do you think could have happened?
It was some kind of order, honestly. Just like, why didn't they touch us in Pakino? It was an order. Because we weren't the first to arrive in Pakino. And we were told that everyone there had been beaten before us. But when we arrived, for some reason it wasn't a resort, but it was peaceful. Sometimes it was scary, but peaceful. And in Mordovia they fed us very well, if you can put it that way, compared to other places. But they beat us too. But then they stopped beating us for some reason.
You're saying January 25th, 2025, right?
Somewhere between January 11th and 18th. Around that time, they stopped beating us. To get beaten, you had to really break some rules, like fighting with others in the cell or something like that, or hiding something. But they didn't beat us like they used to.
And was it actually possible to hide something there?
We'd hide bread so we could eat a little more later, for dinner, for example.
Was that forbidden?
It's forbidden in general. Not only would they beat you for bread, but they'd immediately drag you out and beat you, and then the whole cell would go without bread for a day.
And they'd be angry at you. Well, yeah, were there often conflicts in the cells?
They happened. Honestly, we're all human. Everyone's on edge, and we're all different ages. Soldiers and civilians. People are all different, so they could get into a fight. The administration didn't like that. And if anyone got into a fight, we'd get punished by them too. Sometimes just the ones who fought, sometimes the whole cell. More often the whole cell.
Did any human rights organizations visit?
I can count them on the fingers of one hand. An Orthodox priest in 2022 at Easter. We don't count prosecutors or their inspections. Then in 2023, this Mr. Chichilinsky, a representative of the ombudsman. In 2024, Chichilinsky came again. Another priest and yet another priest. I think that's it. The Red Cross came, but that's not a human rights organization. As for people who would come and look at the beatings or ask questions, we haven't seen anyone like that. Maybe they visited someone else, not us.
The priest, did you have a chance to talk to him?
The door would open and they'd ask, who wants to go to confession? Sometimes people would go out. They'd even get a cross. It went something like this. Are you a sinner? Yes, a sinner. Do you acknowledge your sins? Yes. You may go now. Something like that. So it wasn't like they were taking you somewhere. Maybe they were officially taking someone out. But it was like an assembly line because we had 30 cells in the corridor. And if you take each cell to the priest for 5 minutes per person, almost 300 people, that's a very long time.
So what was the point of that?
To check a box, to show that the priest came. I didn't go at all.
That's interesting. Russia positions itself at least mainly abroad, as an oasis of orthodoxy, an oasis of traditional values.
An Orthodox priest would come, but it didn't do any good. I don't know. Personally, I didn't go. People would go out to him and come back. Nothing. They expected something else, something more. Maybe someone wanted to say something to him, but everyone understood that you're standing there, he's standing there, he's covered you with his sheet, and guards are also standing around you. And if you whisper something to him, and then he says that someone complained to him that they're beating us there, and everyone would get beaten. No one took the risk. They just went out and came back. But they did give us a little cross.
Did they come for any Christian holidays, or did they bring Easter eggs, Easter bread, or anything like that?
They say they brought them in other prisons, not in Novozibkov, not in Pakino. Though we were there during a time when there were no Christian holidays. But in Mordovia, no. No Easter bread, no eggs, nothing. I only ever ate that stuff in Ukraine.
Okay. And did you yourselves know, for example, that today was some kind of holiday, or did you greet each other?
We kept track. And even though it was forbidden to count the days, God forbid you say that you know what day it is, although they themselves understood that we knew everything. But to admit it, to acknowledge it, that was a bad idea.
So it was kind of a game?
Yes, yes. And, well, Easter, Christmas, we knew about those.
Did you mark the days in any way?
In our heads. First of all, there were no pencils or pens there. They didn't give us paper, only where the hymn was printed and those mandatory verses we had to memorize. But writing, recording, none of that was allowed.
How did you keep your spirits up, you and the others in your cell?
I tried to tell stories. Whenever I could, even in Mordovia, we weren't allowed to talk to each other at all. If someone saw your mouth open, or worse, heard you, then either during the morning roll call or right then and there, they'd call in the special forces. The doors would swing open, the cells would open onto the corridor, and they'd start beating everyone. But sometimes we managed to say something in a whisper. I tried to tell stories about history. When they gave us books, it was easier. Sometimes they even let us read aloud. So instead of reading sometimes, I'd just tell a story.
Did you have that radio station that broadcast music and an alternative history from Russia?
Sometimes it was alternative. Sometimes there were actually historical facts that I agreed with. It was there. And in Novozibkov. It was easier in Novozibkov. It only broadcasts something there in the morning. It would stop a couple of hours later. It was really funny when we first heard it. They were talking about agriculture in the Russian Federation. They said they were the best, and then all of a sudden they said, unfortunately, there is a problem with breeding new varieties in Russia. I don't know how they let that slip. One time we heard that recording again, and then just a speech by Putin about how the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. In the Vladimir region, there was more content on that radio station, all kinds of history lectures, but the announcer had such a bad voice, so unpleasant. And in Mordovia, they'd start at 6 a.m. and stop by 10 p.m., and there were songs and all kinds of lectures there.
You, as someone who was interested in history before, based on what they broadcast, to what extent did it correspond to reality, and to what extent did it not?
If you lived through the Soviet era, then all those lectures were, roughly speaking, Soviet history. They told exactly what was in the USSR textbooks. The only thing is that there's some strange mix in them. Lenin is a bad person because he planted a bomb under the Soviet Union, and also Lenin is a hero. How do you reconcile that? I don't know.
Honestly, it seems to me that in the Russian mind, things that are actually incompatible go together very well.
Maybe so. Lenin wrote about the unity and struggle of opposites in his article. That's kind of how it is.
There's this Russian sociologist, Ekaterina Shulman. If I'm not mistaken, she moved to Germany, and I sometimes watch her videos, and I'm actually curious to understand her perspective because she's Russian. She understands her people very well. She's studied them and continues to do so. And she, I think, said something to the effect that the Soviet and now Russian person is someone who have one thing on their minds, say another, what people want to hear from them, but do what is necessary to survive, something like that. And it's just this kind of mentality that already combines the incompatible within itself.
Maybe so. I'd put it a little differently. There's such a mess in their heads that they themselves, it's not that they don't understand, they don't even want to understand what exactly is happening. And they do what they're told. So this propaganda has reached the point where a person can and realizes that they can't make sense of things in their own head, so they just do what they're told.
Like your brain is so jammed up that you can't tell right from wrong or something like that, and you're just open to being told what to do and you'll do it.
Maybe. I don't have an explanation for what's going on with them, but I saw something. They'd sometimes give us a TV and force us to watch it all day. And whoever had a TV in their cell, they left alone. And that's how it moved from cell to cell. so you could watch their talk shows and some kind of informational films all day long.
And could you sit there while doing that?
Yes, you could, and we sat, and they checked to see if we were watching. And then we had to recount the news afterward. They checked. So after I watched it, after watching their TV, I really didn't want to see that TV again the next time, because it was such nonsense. My head was buzzing. I didn't understand at all how anyone could watch or listen to all that. But some people liked it. There were commercials, which were interesting.
Commercials are interesting, but not what they show? Funny. They called you professor, right?
Academician. Well, I just have a college education. Sometimes there were normal people there, locals, I mean, who talked to the guards, and I'd tell them a few things about history. And yeah, rumors spread that I was a professor, an academician. That's what they called me. A historian.
When you talked to them there, to the ones who were more or less sane, did they realize that something was wrong?
No. And I'm talking about this topic. I didn't even bring it up so as not to provoke anything worse, because I understood that any conversation I had could instantly become a threat to the entire cell. I mean, not to provoke. There was a funny story. I think I told different shifts of guards about Bandera and the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, UIA, 3 times. I told them yes, and they were interested in it. And I told them that Stepan Andreyevich Bandera didn't fight against the Russians, he fought against the Soviets, against the communists, and there were Russians and Jews in the UIA. And I just bluntly explained how far the war had gone in Western Ukraine. So they listened to this and then asked, is that good or bad? Well, that's how it was, but, well, you had to be very careful about it. I knew who I could talk to and who I shouldn't tell, once I paid the price for my smarts.
Like you said something and it had consequences?
No, it's just that, well, there were different guards there. Someone didn't like that I was so smart. And a year ago, on November 10th and 11th, for 2 days in a row, they beat my left leg. I mean, first on the 10th and then on the 11th. I was there for 2 months. Well, I could barely walk for a month, and I only started walking again on January 25th.
And did you know that it was because you said something?
I'm smart. Right away, when he first knocked me down, beat me up, I just asked, what did I even do? I didn't provoke anything. And then I remembered that I had once told him that I had a college degree, I refused a month before that to say spasibo, grazhdanin nachalnik. It's like, thank you for when they beat you. You're supposed to say spasibo, spasibo with every blow. But I refused. He remembered that and then he beat me up. And the next day they beat me up again.
Were there any, well, besides the TV and radio, alternative sources of information?
We tried to make the best of any situation. Well, I already mentioned that when we received a package of Ukrainian food from the Red Cross, we just looked to see exactly where it was from, which region it was produced in. That's how we tried to figure out, in general, where military operations were taking place and where they weren't. And we understood that the Mykolaiv region was ours, the Kharkiv region was ours, and the Cherkasy region was ours. During the guards' conversations, when the Kharkiv operation was underway, when the city of Izium was liberated in 2023, while out on a walk, they stood on the top floor, looked at us, and asked, what is this tough special forces unit from Kyiv doing there? We didn't even know yet what had happened, but they were so interested and practically came up to us to ask what kind of tough special forces from Kyiv was deployed in that area.
Did they ask you that?
Well, we were walking around the courtyard, and they were just standing there asking.
So how could you have known while you were in prison?
I don't know. But we realized that something like that had happened there. And then we found out later, thanks to the TV. By the way, as soon as the mobilization started there in September 2022, they immediately stopped giving us TV. Later, we only found out that our forces had liberated Izium and that things were more or less back to normal. We found out about what happened in Kherson quite by accident. We saw an interview on TV with the head of the security service of Ukraine, SBU, in the city of Kherson. And that was so telling. So not in the Kherson region, but in Kherson, in the city. So there's already an SBU office right in the city. And that was a wake-up call that Kherson had to be ours. So part by part, we pieced together the picture. Yeah, yeah. Plus, sometimes they'd call me in to talk to the duty officer. He'd ask if everything was okay in the cell, if anyone was planning to commit suicide, or if there were any plans to escape or riot. And through a few words here and there, we'd find out what was going on. He'd say the war was in full swing, but sometimes he'd get some news. And then I'd tell the guys in the cell that everything was fine. Everything's okay. Hang in there.
Subscribe to our channel, like the video, and click the bell icon so you don't miss the next episode. Weren't there any tensions when, for example, our troops entered the Kursk region? Didn't they take it out on you because of that?
Nothing like that happened.
At least that's a good thing.
I still don't know what happened on July 5th, 2025, when they made us stand in Mordovia again from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Just the day before, on July 4th, we were sitting there for 5 to 6 hours. But on the 5th, we were already up. And it wasn't until August that they allowed us to sit down there for 10 to 15 minutes. They said we were violating the rules, that we were misbehaving, but that wasn't the case. I mean, some kind of order. I don't know why.
Did Russian propaganda have an effect on you? Did they try to Russify you?
First of all, we had to teach our prisoners the Russian language somehow.
Russian?
Yes. There, they beat you for any Ukrainian word you say. Not even for the word itself, but just for the pronunciation, for our pronunciation of the letter G. They beat you. If possible, we tried not to put prisoners from Western Ukraine on guard duty, only those who...
Could speak Russian?
Yes. I know there were people who wanted to go to Russia or even join the army. Our authorities already know this. There were idiots, like that cellmate of ours, who wanted to become Russian. But for some reason, he didn't submit his application last time, but they made it clear there. You write an application for Russian citizenship and you automatically go to the special military operation. He didn't write it anymore.
He must have found out something.
Well, let me put it this way. On July 18th, 2023, when I was mauled by a dog, 20 minutes later they offered us Russian citizenship for the first time. That was up in Mordovia. I would have understood if they'd offered me a Russian passport first, and when I refused, they'd set a dog on me. That would have made any sense. But it turned out the other way around. This man said he was leaving and wrote something down. That was the first time.
I know that in some prisons, the guys there tried to embroider tridents on themselves so they wouldn't be visible, or to have some kind of Ukrainian identity symbol and hide it there. Was that even possible or impossible for you there?
No, it's impossible. We made needles out of bones, but embroidering tridents is very dangerous. Just understand, if one person does something, the other nine suffer for it.
Did you ever think about trying to escape from there?
Let me say right away, all those movies about escaping from prison are nonsense. It's impossible there. You're constantly under surveillance. They're watching you. You can only move in one position. You're not allowed to talk to each other, to the staff, or to other prisoners. Despite these restrictions, I sometimes manage to talk to people. And so, when they first offered us Russian citizenship in Mordovia on July 18th, one of the local inmates who was serving us whispered to me, "Don't even think about signing anything." He said it very quietly so no one would hear. He was handing out food there and the guards were standing around. So he did it that way so they wouldn't hear. He whispered, "Don't even think about signing anything." I concluded that it would be better to tell everyone that something was wrong. There would be trouble if anyone went along with it.
Well, I guess the inmates communicate with each other. They know what happened to those who went to the front lines and either came back or didn't. And according to our data, their losses there are quite significant. How would you describe the ordinary guards who are there? To what extent are they, obviously a person who works as a guard in a prison, you don't expect them to be some highly intellectual person, but humanity, some basic things. To what extent do they have that or not?
Look, there are local guards, staff members, guards, and other personnel. And then there's a new shift that arrives every month. The locals might be mean and nasty at first, but they get tired of it, and they calm down after about a month. But the ones who come in, they show their anger and beat people up. But the locals are already so calm about it. Humanity. When they beat me up back then, one of the locals saw that I wasn't going to the bathhouse. I said I couldn't walk. He asked, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "Well, my leg," and it looked like an elephant's, brown with these purple marks. And he says, "Come on, show me." I showed him, and he understood right away. "That's it," he says. "Put your pants on, stay here." And he said something to the other guy, and they didn't touch me anymore. I don't know. I guess I just got lucky.
So the mercy was that they didn't touch you?
Yes, but there were no offers to get in touch through them or pass anything on. No, nothing like that happened.
Well, what about medicine?
Every day there's a mandatory medical checkup or a doctor comes separately. Like in Mordovia, he came separately. If you're lucky, you can ask for help if you have a toothache, an abscess, or swelling. He gave out medicine and it helped. If it was just a toothache, almost never. But if there was swelling or inflammation, then yes, he helped. He prescribed some medication for people with high blood pressure, but all the tuberculosis patients were transferred to the fourth building, to the hospital ward.
Wasn't that Dr. Evil in Mordovia, as far as I recall?
I personally got shocked by him twice for asking for medicine.
For a tooth?
No, I just had a cold. I didn't know he carried a stun gun. He said, "Give me your hand." So I held it out. He shocked me and asked, "So are you feeling better now?" Later on, we learned to tell them apart by their voices. There was a normal guy there, and the lady was normal too. There was the evil doctor and two nervous women. They'd immediately yell that the clinic wasn't open today, meaning don't even bother asking. Sometimes the attendant, the guard, would also yell not to go to the doctor. So we'd wait for a normal one. A normal doctor, yeah.
Based on your interactions or perhaps how it manifested itself, what was the attitude toward other countries? Toward Ukraine, I suppose, is clear. I'm more interested in the West, Europe, and the United States.
Well, let's put it this way. On May 2nd, 2022, they forced us to shout, "Biden is a jerk."
Yes, you can speak freely. We don't have censorship.
But we realized then that America is helping us. To them, America is Yanks. In general, all of Europe is, first of all, people of non-traditional sexual orientation.
Did they use the term guy rope?
Of course. Faggots, gay rope, gay parades. It's just that if this spreads to Europe, the Europeans need to understand the problem is that in the Russian mind, all Europeans are faggots, fascists, sometimes Nazis, and Russophobes. And all these Europeans, they dream day and night that Russia will be destroyed. Because what are Russians going to do? They have to be the first to come and destroy the enemies. And there was this phrase going around that after Ukraine, we'll go for Poland, Lithuania, and Finland. At that time, Finland wasn't in NATO yet. We heard this again around March 14th, 2022, when we were holed up in the basement of the Gostomel airport. Along with us, along with the local chief guard, a special forces officer came in, an officer. He spoke calmly with us and said that after us, they would immediately move on to Poland, Lithuania, and Finland. And then, on April 8, 2022, in Novozybkov, they gave us a TV. We saw that talk show, and it became clear where those soldiers' thoughts come from, because propaganda is on there all day long. I'm telling you, a Russian resident doesn't just believe it. He simply knows that Europe is the enemy. The United States is the enemy. So we must fight Europe and subjugate it. Why they need that, I don't know. I mean, just Europeans? You'll understand that what you saw in Bucha, if Russia comes after you, it'll be the same for you. But on a larger scale, because Ukrainians are still, on some level in the Russian mind, kind of like brothers. But those Poles, and especially the Germans, they're fascists. So the conversation with you will be very brief. If you're comforting yourselves with the thought that there are normal Russians out there, well, the abnormal Russians are the ones who will come for you. And when the first sweep happened at my place on March 5th, I told you about it. Those were very normal people, soldiers of the Russian Federation. Calm, educated, spoke clearly, no swearing. They didn't beat anyone, but they're contract soldiers. They signed a contract to come and kill Ukrainians for money. Just understand that this is how it is. No one there is going to care whether you're a good European or a bad one. You're already one of them, just like we're all Benderites. And the Poles, the Germans, they're definitely fascists to them. Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Finland already.
By the way, I wonder if their opinion has evolved at all over these 4 years, if they've realized they can't handle us there, and whether Finland, Latvia, and so on are in their future.
I don't think so, because on January 6th, 2023, in the Bryansk region, we heard the phrase, "We attacked the wrong people." They were talking among themselves. We could hear it. Who they were supposed to attack, I don't know. They didn't say it was a big mistake that they attacked. No, they said, "We attacked the wrong ones." Who exactly would have been the right ones? Well, they probably thought they should have gone after Lithuania, the Baltics. But instead, they went after Ukraine. Maybe Poland via Belarus, I don't know.
I've been involved in our advocacy efforts for Ukraine in Europe. I've been to many countries, including Latvia. And in Latvia, the government fully understands the threat hanging over it. I think it's much the same situation in Estonia and Lithuania. The only problem is that they're small. No matter how motivated they are, no matter what they do, if this entire armada currently in our country were to descend on them, I'm afraid they'd have little chance.
But we have to be prepared. Honestly, I recalled this phrase while in captivity. Once the war had already begun, I remembered Golda Meir's words, "If someone tells you they want to kill you, believe them."
An extended version of this conversation is available on Patreon. Please subscribe and help us translate this conversation into more languages. This will enable a wider audience to discover our stories.